You're listening to Hearing Our Heritage, the podcast where we preserve the voices and stories of the older generation and make them accessible to younger ears. We pay tribute to those who have paved the way and learn from their lived experiences. I'm your host, Katie Pierce.
I'm Rhea Nielsen Rader. I was born December 9th, 1933, in my parents' home in Elwood, Utah.
If you talk to Rhea Rader, she'll probably tell you that she's had a very ordinary life, but she has nearly 90 years of stories that say otherwise. She grew up in rural Utah, sometimes living without power or plumbing. She met her sweetheart Bill when she was still in high school, and they raised 6 children together. They also ran a physical therapy office and served 2 church missions. She has 31 grandchildren, 43 great-grandchildren, and 1 great-great-grandchild with another on the way. If that's not an extraordinary life, I don't know what else is. Sitting with Rhea, I could see in her eyes just how much her family means to her, starting with her parents and siblings. Rhea was born in Elwood, Utah, to Wilford W. Nielsen and Leona Christensen Nielsen. And believe it or not, that very day, something unusual happened to kick off her remarkable life. Rhea, let's start with day one. What happened the day that you were born?
1933 was in the midst of the Great Depression. My parents were poor farmers. My mother told me, I think it was that winter that I was born, they had their coal for the winter and $35 to make it through the winter. So they were pretty poor. So I guess this doctor thought he was probably offering them something really great because he offered them $1,000 for me and told them that he would be sure that I was adopted into one of the best families in Salt Lake. My mother used to say, we didn't take the $1,000 when she was born. We waited for 18 years and then we gave her away.
Your mom sounds like she had a great sense of humor. What else can you tell me about her and her family?
My mother was the next to the last one in her family of 12, and I was the last one in my family. So my grandfather was old, old, old by the time I came along. I never saw my grandma Christensen out of bed. That's my mother's mother. My dad's mother died when I was just little, and his stepdad died then too. So the only grandparent I really knew was my grandfather. Well, by the time I was old enough to know who he was probably 90.
Oh, wow, yeah. So you really didn't get to know your grandparents very well. But you were really close with your parents, and you spent a lot of time outside with your dad. What do you remember about him?
On Sunday morning, we had the funnies that came with the, call them commies now. But I'd go and sit on his lap and read the funnies. And there'd be Tarzan and Little Orphan Annie and Little Abner. And so I'd crawl up on his lap and we'd read funnies. That was my big deal for the week. And when I was little, I'd get a lot of earaches. When I'd get one in the night, I'd go and crawl in the bed with my mom and dad, and my dad would breathe into it, and the moist, warm air would make it feel better. And my dad didn't have any top teeth. My sister said that one day he just came home from Tremonton and he'd had his top teeth pulled. Well, I'm thinking back about that. That's another thing that poor people did because he probably couldn't afford to have them fixed. Now that I think about it, I am so sorry that my parents had to work so very hard. We were poor.
Rhea's family really did work so hard, growing crops, raising animals, and milking cows. And now she has countless stories about fun times and adventures on the farm.
When we were still living in Elwood, I had an aunt who lived in Southern California, and she brought me a desert tortoise. And I remember we called him Pipsqueak, and my dad drilled a hole in his shell and tied a cord on it. And we put him out on the lawn. One day I went out there and he was not there. The cord was broken. We didn't find him until the next spring. He was out in the field, dead. Well, actually, it was just a shell we found out in the field.
Did you spend your whole childhood in Elwood?
We lived in Elwood until I was 7. And then we moved to a farm in Honeyville, which was basically just over the Bear River, pretty much from where we were.
And what year was that?
the spring of 1941. That time was the only time I ever felt any insecurity. And I remember I was riding in the car with my dad one day. He had been told we had to move, but we hadn't found a place to go yet. So I said to Dad, what are we going to do if we don't find a place? And he says, I don't know, go crawl in a cave, I guess. Well, I'm sure he didn't mean that at all. But I thought, oh my gosh, that really didn't go well with me at all. But we moved there, and the farm that we moved on to didn't have any electricity. And to get the wires strung from where there was electricity to the farm, you had to have so many, they called them units, meaning you had to have so many things that would use electricity to make it worth to bring it. Well, so the units my dad and mother chose was enough cows that they could use electric milkers on. That's how we got the electricity. But until then, I remember there was at least one summer, probably only one, that we didn't have electricity because they had, you know, cows. My mother churned our own butter, but she would also put milk in what she called butter bowls, and it would just go sour. We called it clabber, and it's kind of like yogurt, except a little more tangy. And we'd put cream and sugar on it, and it was not too bad.
Was it kind of like sour cream then?
It was, yeah. But the thing was, my mother would put the milk in these things, and it would sit overnight. And by that time, the cream had risen to the top, and there'd be like half an inch of cream. You could lay a tablespoon on top of that, and it wouldn't sink because there was so much cream, and it was solid. So she'd skim that off, and what we drank was blue.
Very, very skim milk.
Very, very skimmed. And as far as I remember, my mother always helped my dad with the chores. I know from the time we lived in Honeyville, that time and on, she always milked with him. I don't know how many cows they had, maybe 20 or so, but they never asked any of us kids to help with that. We'd go out and help in the fields. We'd thin beets and top beets and pick up potatoes and cut hay and haul hay, but we never did help with the daily chores for some reason.
So not the cows, but you were helping with the other animals. So what happened when you were helping with the chickens?
My mother would give me a little lard bucket, and I'd go over and gather the eggs. Well, one day, there were no eggs. So when I came back over the canal, I threw the bucket in the water because I thought, why do I need it? There are no eggs. So I told my mother, and she was a little upset. She explained to me that, well, maybe there'll be eggs tomorrow, and you might need the bucket then. But it didn't occur to me at the time.
Did you ever get paid for what you did on the farm, or was it just expected, or did you get an allowance or anything like that?
I remember one time being with my dad, and he was talking to a neighbor who had sheep, and he was having them move from one field to another, and there was a wooden gate. And he said, if you'll hold the gate open, I'll give you a quarter. That was my first earned money. I got a quarter for holding the gate.
That's pretty good for those days, a whole quarter, and just for opening a gate. That's good. So I've heard that you had a little mishap when you did a job you weren't supposed to be doing.
When they would cut the grain and thresh it, they would throw the straw up on the top of a three-sided cow shed. So that would make a roof, and it would make it easy for my dad to be able to just go up there and throw the straw down for bedding for the cows. So one day I thought, well, I'll help Dad. So I got up on the roof with his pitchfork and gave a big jab with a pitchfork to throw it down there, and got a tine in my foot. So I didn't want to tell anybody because, of course, I'd been disobedient. Shouldn't have been up there in the first place. But by evening, I was kind of limping, and they took me to the doctor in Tremont.
Oh, no. So you got found out. And you went to Tremont. So at the time, that was kind of the next big town. Did you go there very often? Did you get to go to town?
If I knew my dad was going to town, to Tremont, I'd always want to go with him because he had a real sweet tooth, and so did I, of course. And so if I ever went with him, I'd always get an ice cream cone. But sometimes in the evening, when it was really, really hot, this didn't happen very often, we'd go to Tremont, and there was an ice cream place, but we'd just all sit in the car. They'd get a milkshake that was like a quart and a half. And they'd share that, and I'd get an ice cream cone.
That's such a cool memory. It sounds like going to town was kind of a treat because you lived in more of a rural area. Did many people live out near you? Did you have any neighbors?
The only neighbors we had were the Japanese family directly across this gravel road. And then a mile or two up the road, there was another house. And then about once a year, their old hog would get out and come ambling down the road, scare me to death. I wasn't scared of the cows or horses, but that pig just scared me to death. And we had an outhouse that was on the canal bank. And I remember going there once and looked down the hole. And there was what I thought at first was a colored belt. It was a snake. Scared me to death. I got out of there really, really fast.
Outhouses, snakes, hogs. That sounds really eventful. What else can you tell me about your life growing up on the farm? I know you have more stories.
One thing we would do in the summertime, my sister would get on the bike, and it was a boy's bike, and I'd sit on the bar between the handlebars and the seat. And when wagons would come by with pea vines on them, we'd go up along the wagon, and I would pull pea vines off, and then we would sit and eat peas. It was fun. I wish everybody could have that kind of a childhood.
Yeah, it sounds really magical. What about birthdays and holidays? What were the celebrations like?
The only birthday party I had ever, I think I was about 5. And the thing I remember about it was that we had suckers, red Santa Clauses and green Christmas trees. That was big stuff. And then when Christmas would come, my dad had been to California once to visit some of the relatives down there. And when he came back, he brought this string of lights. It was just one string, but it had an orange and a cluster of grapes, a Japanese lantern, a parrot, just really pretty fun stuff. And so we'd put the one string of lights on our Christmas tree and put the ornaments on. And then we would hang icicles, which were probably made of lead. When you turned the lights on, then they'd twinkle, and it was kind of fun. But my mother would make me wear these long cotton stockings because it was cold. And there was a little garter belt thing that you'd have to hook it on to hold them up. And I'd just beg her, please don't make me wear those. Let me wear anklets. And she said, no. And I remember talking to one of my friends who got to wear anklets all the time and said, how does your mom let you wear anklets? My mom won't let me. Anyway, one of those old long stockings was all I had to put up for Santa. And I remember I'd always get an orange in the toe. And as far as I remember, that's the only time my mother and dad bought nuts. And they'd buy them in the shells. My mother would crack them, and then she'd grind them so that my dad could eat them. And I thought, ground nuts. That doesn't sound very good at all.
So you had oranges, ground nuts, and I've heard about a special drink. What was that?
Danish beer, except they called it Christmas cheer. But apparently my mother was the only one who remembered how to make it. And my grandpa loved it. So we had this big 20-gallon crock. That thing would be full when she got all the ingredients in it. I don't know whether it was alcoholic, but I know that after it had been made for about 2 weeks, if I drank it, my arms would tingle. I don't know if it was alcoholic, but it made me tingle. Yeah. But my mother wrote that recipe down. She said, keep the kids away from the crock, because my sister fell backwards into it once when it was full of beer. I loved to be outside. I didn't like to be in playing with dolls and that kind of stuff. I liked to be out playing with my dog or the cats. Or sometime my dad would let me ride on the farm equipment with him. I loved to be with him when he'd plow, because I'd love to see that earth turn over. And this sounds really strange, but I really even loved the smell of the horses when they were sweaty. I loved those horses. They were so great. Like I told you, I loved to be outside with my dad. And when he would come in and unharness the horses, sometimes he'd let me ride on old Belle. Belle was a really good horse. She was little as far as workhorses go, but she was really a good worker. And this one time I wanted to ride on her, and he'd already turned her loose. But he said I could ride on old Chub. Well, Chub was a big bay horse, but Chub was lazy. So he put me on him, and he still had his harness on, which had the strap going down the back with the metal rings on it and everything. So I'm sitting on those things. So I go down the field, kicking a horse in the ribs the whole way, trying to get him to go more than just a slow walk. He'd never gone faster than a slow walk in his whole life until we turned around to go home. And then he broke into a trot. And I'm bouncing up and down on this strap the whole. And my mother's standing out there on the bridge yelling, "Hang on, Rhea, hang on." Our one horse king was a big, pretty sorrel horse. Once in a while, in the summertime, the river would be really low. King would go down to the river. He would go across it and sit there and eat weeds all day. So my dad would say to Spike, "Go get King." And it wouldn't matter where the dog was. He would go down and go across the river and bark at the horse until he got him to come home. But the weird thing is, I think they had a little pact, because Spike would go over there and he'd bark and bark and bark, and then he'd get tired. Then he'd lay down in the shade of the horse. And it was like the horse would say, "Okay, I know you've got a job to do. I'll cooperate, but I'm not quite ready. Just take it easy." When we lived in Honeyville, there was a lot of snow. And this particular year, it was really windy. And our lane was drifted in, and so was the North Road. And so I rode the only riding horse we ever had. His name was Chief. He was a white, kind of gray, speckled. And he didn't look like he could move very fast, but he could. But anyway, I would ride him down the lane and to one of the more main roads that would have been cleared that the bus could get to. And then I'd get off and put the reins on the saddle and give him a pat and say, "Go home, Chief." And he'd go home. But we had that horse all while I was growing up, until I left home. So he was old. I don't know how old he was when I did another dumb thing, but there were a couple of neighbor boys. They had their horses, and I was on Chief. They were kidding me about how this double gray horse couldn't move. And I said, "I'll race you down to your lane." So we raced, and I won. But it was a really stupid thing, because this was a gravel road. If that horse had stumbled on that gravel, I'd have been shredded. It was really dumb, but I won.
But you won. And that's not the only thing that you won. You were crowned the Peach Queen of Brigham City.
Brigham City is the peach capital of the world, unless you go to Georgia. So they have this big celebration every year. So I'm a junior in high school, and I get this phone call this one day, and this man says, "We'd like you to be a Peach Queen contestant, and Brown Shoe Shop is your sponsor." I had never heard of Brown Shoe Shop. Had no idea who they were. So I thought, okay. So you had to go and parade around in a swimsuit and just a regular outfit and formal. When I was in high school, I started taking a shorthand class and thought, I'm never going to use this. So I stopped that and took a homemaking class and learned to sew. From that time on, I made every dress my mother ever wore. And I made my formal for my Peach Queen thing and made my outfit. And I won, which just blew my mind. I couldn't believe it.
That beauty pageant wasn't the only performing that Rhea did. She was also part of a girls' singing trio.
We sang all over Box Elder County. We sang at weddings. We sang in church. We sang during parades. We sang at the county fair. We sang all over. We had a really good time. We called ourselves the Honey Tones.
Besides basically being a local celebrity for her part in the Honey Tones, Rhea had another unique thing about her high school experience.
We had release time seminary, if you can believe it. And my first year, I had A. Theodore Tuttle as my seminary teacher. The next year, I had Boyd K. Packer. Can you believe that? In this little Box Elder seminary. And they didn't teach very long. They taught all while I was in high school, but I think it was not very much longer after that, then they both were called to be general authorities. Brother Tuttle was fun. He was bald, and he would say, "The Lord only made a few perfect heads, and the rest he put hair on."
As you've heard, Rhea had such a fun childhood. The farm, her horses, singing in the Honey Tones, being crowned Peach Queen, and everything in between. The next chapters of her life actually began while she was still in high school, and she went with a friend to a roller skating event.
We'd go up to Crystal Springs, up to the dance hall, a.k.a. roller skating rink. Every Wednesday, you could skate for about 3 hours for 50 cents. And that included the skates. This one night, my sister Marie was supposed to pick me up, take me home. And she was there, but she was also there with her boyfriend, and they were having an argument. So it gets to be like 11 o'clock or so, and I'm thinking, how long is this going to go on? Well, I had gone with my friend Nora, who was different than the friend I usually went with. And she lived not very far from Crystal Springs. And there were two guys there from Corinne. I didn't know either of them, but she knew one of them. And they offered to take us home. And since she knew one, I thought, okay, that'll work. So that was how I met my future husband.
No kidding.
One of those boys was Bill. Bill and Murph. Bill and Murph were also the first ones to sign up when the Korean War broke out. They enlisted in the Navy because neither one of them wanted to be in the Army.
And did you like him immediately? Was it love at first sight? Or was he just a guy and it kind of grew later?
Just a guy. Later he called and said, you want to go? I'm not sure where. It's probably a movie or something. We'd go to movies and dances. And there was one night, I'd been going with him quite a while. I was probably a sophomore. There was a dance in Korean. It was cold. It had been snowing, but it was really, really cold. And the lane was drifted in. And so they could drive through the field right up to the fence and we could crawl over the fence in your formal and get in the car and go. But I remember when my dad went out to milk that night, he knew I had a date and he says, don't tell him to come through the field. Well, I didn't want to go down the snowy lane in my formal. So I told him, I think it'd be okay. He come through the field. Well, they could get clear down to the fence. They got almost to the fence. They got stuck. This is in a muddy field, and my poor dad. He's out milking. So what does he have to do? He has to go catch the horses, harness the horses, take them out, hook them up to the car, and pull the car out, and then go let the horses loose. And all he said to me when he came into the house was, thanks for telling him to come through the field. I felt about that big. And while they were waiting for him to get the team hooked up to the car, one of the horses was pawing. And Bill's friend Murph was holding the horses, and every time the horse would paw, he'd get splattered with mud. He had to go home and change his clothes before he'd go to the dance.
Despite the muddy mishap, Bill and Rhea had a great time dating before he left with the Navy. In the meantime, Rhea dated around and enjoyed high school, but by the time she graduated, she and Bill had decided that they would spend the rest of their lives together.
When I graduated from high school, I knew that Bill and I wanted to get married in the fall. And so my sister Marie had gotten married the year before, and she and her husband lived in Logan. So I knew if I got a job in Logan, I had a place to live. So I went down and talked to them at JCPenney's in Logan. And they said, no, we really don't need anybody right now. So I went back. I don't know how I had the nerve to do this. And I said, I know you need somebody until September. I'm available until September. And they hired me.
Rhea's new employment paid a little bit better than her job as a gate holder when she was a kid. In fact, it got her enough money that she could start preparing for her upcoming wedding.
I went down to the print shop and ordered our invitations. And I went to the jewelers and bought Bill's ring and went to a place that was dressmaking. I don't know why I did this, but I had this feeling that I wanted this velvet dress. If you're going to have a velvet dress, it better be pretty cool weather. So we were going to get married in September, and I thought, maybe we push it back to October. That'll work. So we did. We were supposed to get married the 3rd of October. That's what it said on our invitations. But we didn't realize that 3rd of October was General Conference. The temples were closed. So we got married the 2nd of October in the Logan Temple. And just had a reception on the 3rd. But, you know, now you have a lot of people come and go with you through the temple. They put 7 couples in one room, and that's how we got married. The only people that were with us were my parents and Bill's parents and my sister.
After the wedding, the newlyweds headed up to Seattle, where Bill was stationed. Young, poor, but very happy together.
he got a little apartment for us up there. It was close to the base. I think $50 a month, furnished, with a day bed, a kitchen table, and two chairs, and a bed to sleep on. That was about it. But yeah, we didn't care. But we didn't have a car, and so there were a couple of friends that he had known before I got up there, and one of them had a car. But they were as poor as we were. I remember one time we were going somewhere, and this kid said, I've got to stop and get some gas. He stopped and got 50 cents worth of gas, which is probably a couple gallons.
Rhea was able to find a job in the advertising department at Ma Bell Telephone Company for 5 months. In those days, you couldn't work if you were more than 5 months pregnant, so she wasn't there terribly long. Almost exactly a year after their wedding, on October 17th, they welcomed their first baby, Bruce.
He was born at Army Hospital. A year later, Bill's enlistment was up. He got out of the Navy, and we went to Rexburg, Idaho, coldest place in the U.S. We went there because one of his Navy buddies was from there. His dad had a dairy farm. Now we're back to the cows. So Bill had a job milking cows night and morning. But we got there at the beginning of the school year. Well, he was in a PE class one day and was looking at some manual, and it said, if you're interested in physical therapy, see something, something at Utah State University. So he came home and said, I'm going to be a physical therapist. On my birthday, December 9th, we borrowed our landlord's truck. We put all of our stuff in it, drove down to Logan. And we lived in that little apartment for probably almost a year. Because when Jeff was born, we were not in that apartment anymore. We were in a little house. So we had Debbie and Jeff in Logan. By this time, Bill had graduated. And to get his physical therapy certificate, he had to go for another year. So he got a scholarship, $130 a month. So we went down to Stanford and lived in this apartment that was part of a hospital during World War II. So we lived there until he got his certificate. And then Bill got this job in Concord. Chris was born when we were in Concord. And pretty soon Janelle. And then we moved from that house to a bigger house because it was getting a little crowded around that table in the kitchen. And that's where Denise was born.
It was while they were living in Concord that the family got involved in the Oakland Temple pageant, which became a big part of their lives. The pageant was a performance put on by the local church members, with a cast of 150 to 200, speaking parts, music, dancing, costumes, and more. It was a huge undertaking, and because of that, the job of producer was supposed to rotate to different people, but that wasn't the case for Bill.
He ended up being producer like about 3 years, I think. There was one year that I was in stage chorus, Denise is in stage chorus, and dancing, and Janelle was dancing, and so was Chris, and my husband was producing. But every year, they'd change it a little bit because the people who were doing the music would keep writing beautiful songs, and they didn't want to ever take any songs out, but they just kept adding them. Finally, the last year my husband was producer, he said, this is just too long. We're cutting this down to an hour and a half.
Cutting it down to an hour and a half. Oh my gosh. Well, that sounds like a really great experience for your whole family. And I know that there was a miracle that happened for you during the pageant. You were working with the costumes, and there were so many kids coming in and out. Can you tell me what happened?
So this one year, it's the night before dress rehearsal, and lots of busy stuff going on. And we'd often have kids that we knew weren't in the pageant, but they would invite their friends to come and see rehearsals and stuff. So that night, there seemed to be an awful lot of kids that I hadn't seen before. Well, when I went to get my purse, I picked it up. And as soon as I picked it up, I knew my wallet wasn't in it. It was a wallet where you could take out one part. And the money was in one part and my driver's license and stuff. And then credit cards and other stuff were in another part. This is dress rehearsal. Starts at 8 o'clock in the morning and goes until 7 that night. And I had to be there. Because that's my thing. It's the costumes, you know. So I just said, Heavenly Father, I know that this is really important and that we have to get this done. Please don't let anybody use my credit cards. Because I couldn't even call. I didn't have time. Okay, so we get through Saturday. Sunday comes. Bill's on the high council. And because he's been so busy with temple pageant, I take the kids to go to our ward. And he stays home to finish his talk to go to a ward a little later. The phone rings. It's a woman that lives just down the hill from the temple pageant. I have a wallet here. She had been good enough to look up our number and call. About 15 minutes after that, another call. This one is from a lady who lives down by the Oakland Airport, which is just a few miles away from the temple pageant. She had the other part of my wallet. I got everything that was in that wallet back, except the $20 that I had gotten so I could pay for lunches that Saturday. Every single thing.
Participating in the temple pageant was just one highlight of the Raiders' family life, amongst many more. And just like that, Bill and Rhea's six kids were all grown up. Denise, their youngest, was a senior in high school when Bill and Rhea took a big career step. Bill was still working as a physical therapist, but decided it was time to move away from his partners. Rhea had taken some community college courses, and one was on office administration. Together, they opened and ran their own physical therapy office. Unfortunately, Bill had a bad knee, which took him out of the physical therapy game, and the Raiders moved to Logan, Utah. But it was time for them to embark on their next adventure of being church missionaries.
We went on our first mission to Nauvoo in 1994. We were tour guides, we were in period dress, and we were also in a skit that night at the cultural hall. We were just there a year. A few months after we'd gotten home, we got a call from some good friends who we'd been with in Nauvoo. And they had gone on a mission to the Joseph Smith Birthplace in Vermont. They were due to be released in about 6 weeks. The director of that birthplace was one of their neighbors. He said, "Do you know of anybody who's like you, who's had experience with tours and stuff?" So he called us, and we went to Vermont for a year.
Rhea Raider has had so many interesting and fun things happen in her life. Her childhood on the farm, building a life with Bill, and serving so freely in the church. But she'll tell you the most important things to her are her family and the gospel of Jesus Christ.
I don't really know how to put it into words what a family could mean to you. But I have just been so blessed that I have really good children who love each other and who love the gospel. I'm also so grateful for what good people they are, really good people. They all enjoy each other, and that's one thing that I really am happy about. My parents never showed me any affection. It's not that I felt like I didn't have affection, but it wasn't demonstrated. No kissing, no hugging, never. I never saw my mother and dad express affection to each other or any of them, their other family, when they would meet with families or friends. You know, now it's hugs and I love you, and I'm glad about that. But it's hard for me still, even with my own family. And I didn't do that with them growing up. I wish I had. I wish I'd given them more hugs and bedtime kisses and all that stuff. But I'm just really blessed that the Lord gave me a family that made it in spite of me. I have a really great family. One of the things about the gospel, and one of the things the Savior said, is, "My peace I give unto you." I don't worry about all this stuff that's going on in the world. I worry about my grandkids with the stuff that they're going to have to go through. But I also know that each generation comes with the tools that they need to succeed if they want to.
Rhea Raider has succeeded in living a beautiful life and leaving a legacy of hard work, faith, and love for her family. Her stories and memories are priceless, and her life, contrary to what the doctor appraised her at, is worth much more than $1,000. A huge thank you to Rhea Raider for letting me interview her for this episode, and thank you to the Raider family. If you have somebody you would like to have featured on Hearing Our Heritage, email hearingourheritage@gmail.com.